Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast, the podcast that's dedicated to bridging the divide between the police and the communities that they serve. Got a good episode for you today, something that I've been interested in that kind of bothered me for a little bit. And we're going to take a look at dollar stores and their impact upon the community. And some cities and towns have taken measures as to criminalize them. So we're going to take a look at that. And my special guest for today is Steve Malanga. He's a researcher who has been studying this phenomenon. So I reached out to him and he was so gracious enough to agree to be on the podcast. So here's just a little bit about my guest for today, Steve Malanga. He is the George M. Yeager Fellow at the Manhattan Institute and City Journal's senior editor. He writes about the intersection of urban economies, business communities, and public policy. Malanga is the author of The New Left, How American Politics Works Today, The Immigration Solution, A Better Plan Than Today's, written back in 2007, and that was co-authored with Heather McDonald and Victor Davis Hanson, and Shakedown, The Continuing Conspiracy Against the American Taxpayer, written in 2010. In 2013, former Governor Jeb Bush called Malanga the best thinker on state and local fiscal matters in a tweet. In a 2014 Manhattan Institute speech, he said that Malanga's warnings on state's coming debt and pension crisis had influenced fiscal reforms undertaken in Florida. Before joining City Journal, Malanga was an executive editor of Crain's New York Business, serving on the publication's editorial board and writing a weekly column. Prior to that, he was managing editor of Crain's. During his tenure at the publication, he twice won the General Excellence Award from the Association of Arab Business Publications. In 1995, Malanga was a finalist for the Gerald Loeb Award for Excellence in Financial Journalism for the series Nonprofits, New York's New Tammany Hall, which he co-authored. He's also been a writer for the Wall Street Journal, LA Times, New York Times, New York Daily News, and the New York Post. So he's a well-rounded individual. He's got a BA in English. He's also got his MA from University of Maryland. So I was really pleased to speak to him concerning the subject and the criminalization that people want to, these different cities and taking what many would consider drastic measures as far as passing laws and regulations to make sure that dollar stores do not come into their community. So we're going to have that discussion for today. So I'm really hoping you guys get into it and enjoy it. Make sure that you please rate, subscribe, and share these episodes of Captain Hunter's Podcast. And remember, you can support the podcast through PayPal, Cash App, and Venmo. Also go over to the Patreon page, Captain Hunter's Podcast on Patreon. And without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, here is the interview with Steven Malanga. So thank you very much, Steven Malanga, for being on Captain Hunter's Podcast. It really is an honor and a pleasure to talk to you today.
Well, my pleasure.
So can you just tell the audience a little bit about yourself before we get started here?
I for years was a financial journalist writing in New York City. Over time, I got interested in what I call the intersection of business and public policy and government, because, of course, government has a huge influence on the way businesses operate. And after years and years of writing for business magazines, I found my way to a public policy magazine at a think tank, because I wanted to write more about the policy side of it. And much of what I do, including this latest article on dollar stores and cities and city policies or zoning policies, I think is a reflection of that.
Okay. And what drew you to the public policy side? Many people may find that to be a little bit boring, but...
Well, I have to tell you, one thing I specialized in for years when I was working at business magazines was writing about small businesses. And small businesses who oftentimes don't have the resources to deal with government were often expressed to me that they felt very vulnerable to government policies that could basically undermine them, you know, at the snap of a finger, unlike big companies, which maybe have the resources to fight or to, you know, just to, if something, you know, something changes, government changes something that undermines their marketplace, they can, you know, they have the wherewithal to withstand it maybe. So I got very interested in the impact, particularly on small businesses, and spent quite a bit of time writing about that. And then I just thought, well, you know, it's most people in government and most people who write about government don't actually have a perspective of, you know, looking at it from the business owners and the entrepreneurs' point of view. And I thought, well, I could bring that to this. And that's what sort of, you know, got kind of flipped the table and pushed me into, you know, writing about this, all of this from a government point of view.
Mm. Okay. Okay. So what drew me to your attention, is this article that you did write, Unjust Deserts, or Deserts, Unjust Deserts. And I was kind of doing a lot of research about exactly what you're talking about, small business, how it affects the economy, not only in rural places, but I grew up in inner city in Connecticut. And so I saw a lot of small little bodegas, barbershops, small mom and pop stores, things like that. And I saw them start to decline, to disappear. And I, you know, just continued to read on. And then, you know, eventually I came to see your works. I wanted to explore this concept of dollar stores who are taken over. Even we may get into this a little bit later, even the larger chains like Walmart taking over and kind of moving these mom and pop stores out of the communities and everything like that. So what caused you to write this article, Unjust Deserts, which can be read in cityjournal.org, what caused you to write it?
Well, I spend a lot of my time, because I'm really interested in government policy from the point of view of states and municipalities rather than Washington, D.C., for the most part. I spend a lot of time reading what's going on across the country. And I had read a couple of articles about cities that were contemplating either banning or restricting these dollar stores because they said that they were contributing, if you will, to the obesity and the lack of good food in urban neighborhoods or in poorer rural neighborhoods too. And I found this just a little bit astonishing, the connection. I think of all the things I think about with dollar stores, I don't think about them as being competition for supermarkets. And that was explicitly what some of these stories said, and some of the council people and the mayors in these cities said, that essentially these dollar stores, which mostly sell packaged food, were making it difficult for supermarkets to compete in some urban neighborhoods, and as a result, supermarkets weren't opening there. And I just found this kind of fantastic, because as someone who actually, in the early days, I wrote extensively about retailing as a business, I just find that, you know, supermarkets sell a lot of stuff that other stores sell, but they also sell a lot of stuff that is unique. And I couldn't imagine, you know, a dollar store being a reason that a supermarket wouldn't open up in a neighborhood. But what really got me is just the idea that these public officials, it's not like they were trying, let's say, to just lure supermarkets to their city or to certain neighborhoods. They were actively looking to ban dollar stores. And I thought, well, that's a really big leap to make, you know, and so I thought this would be interesting to write about. And frankly, the response to this particular article, which actually broke our record on our website for the largest single day traffic, suggests that most people found this interesting too. Yes, it did. So a lot of people found this very interesting. And I think that's because many people, and not just certainly in lower income neighborhoods, shop in dollar stores. And I think people kind of identify with these kinds of stores. Everybody loves a bargain, to tell you the truth. So I just think a lot of people, if you read the comments, and we had over 500 comments on the on our site on the story, if you read the comments, most people just find it incredible that, you know, a government would say to a certain kind of store, you can't go into that neighborhood, when the reason they're there is because people in the neighborhood are shopping at these stores. Otherwise, they just would close up and wouldn't stay.
Yeah, so I do agree with that assessment concerning the you know, supermarkets are can't compete. I do think that's, as you said, fantastic. I think that that's a little bit of a stretch, and I don't really have much issue with that. My biggest issue when I was doing my own research, and maybe you can speak to this, is the lack of what they don't bring to the community, right? They're not bringing jobs. Many times in these stores, there's one or two persons who are working. So it's contributing, or in your opinion, is it contributing to the economic decline of certain neighborhoods?
Well, I don't know how it would actually contribute to the economic decline. Most of these stores are under 10,000 square feet. The stores that I am aware of, the Dollar General stores, they do have more than one or two people. However, these stores are not by themselves an economic engine by any means, meaning it's not like they are bringing hundreds of jobs to a neighborhood, that's for sure. But that's not the primary primary purpose of these stores. The primary purpose of the stores is to serve the neighborhood. And the question you have to ask yourself is, if these stores weren't there, what would be there? For some reason, you know, or would anything be there? For some reason, the people, these government officials are assuming that if they weren't there, a supermarket would be there. And I just find that to be a big leap. And not only that, but you mentioned, you know, there are larger stores. Walmart's are a good example. And sometimes I'll give you an example. There was an example years ago of a Walmart store that went into a neighborhood, and it was a lower income neighborhood where a Macy's had previously been, and Macy's as a department store was closing up a lot of its stores. And the site had sat empty for a while, and then Walmart decided to go there. And there were protests in the neighborhood because many of the local council people were associated with a certain anti-Walmart groups. And they said that, well, you know, Walmart was an exploitative employer and everything like that. On the first day that Walmart started hiring, 10,000 people showed up for jobs there. And some of the community leaders changed their opinion. They said, well, wait a minute. They said, the community says it wants this. Why should we say that they shouldn't be here? So for me, if people are shopping in these stores, I mean, that's the purpose of the stores. And why should a government leader say, you know, you shouldn't be here? And I don't understand the argument that they're actually helping the neighborhood decline, because how could a store in a lower income neighborhood that's actually occupying a space and paying rent to a landlord be helping the neighborhood to decline? Particularly because if you look at the occupancy level, the retail occupancy level in poorer neighborhoods, lower income neighborhoods, it tends to have a lot of vacant storefronts and stuff. It'd be different if they were, you know, opening or kicking somebody out and you know what I mean, opening it. But that's not necessarily the case. So I'm not sure how they can be, you know, dragging the neighborhood down by opening there and selling stuff to people that who want to come in and buy.
Sure. And I don't proclaim to be an economic expert. Matter of fact, I don't think I've ever taken an economics class. I've always taken some different elective. But I would question, and I guess, and my assumption is that if these stores come into town, whether it's a larger store chain like Walmart, they would probably do some type of comparative analysis to, let's just say, the Macy's store that you had. It was Macy's that was there paying their, and I don't know, like I said, I'm not an economic expert by any stretch, but was Macy's paying their employees more and compared to now the Walmart who's there? So if Macy's is paying, let's just say, you know, back in the days they were paying $15 and now Walmart comes in and they're paying $9. I mean, so that's that, and maybe some of the employees at Macy's were getting medical benefits. Maybe that is some of the reasons that people are saying it's contributing to economic decline. I know that that's why some people have a large problem with Walmart, because they're not paying the Walton family's making millions. They're not paying comparative rates, and they're not giving their employees medical benefits.
Right, but remember the example that I gave you. Macy's had already closed up and were gone. So
right.
It's not like they were being driven out. They were just gone, and this was an empty building for a couple of years. In the case of these dollar stores, there's no example I have heard of in these neighborhoods where dollar stores are coming in places where there's plenty of retail and they're just like essentially knocking other people out. I mean, in many of these neighborhoods, there are a lot of vacant storefronts. Why would you not want to have a retailer actually in a storefront paying rent, offering goods to the people in the community? And look, if they're not offering the goods that people want, or if they're too expensive, people aren't going to buy them. But the biggest benefit of retail competition and the fact that just, someone occupying a space is they're offering choices to the community. Because if you don't have choices in a community, then that's really the way you're being exploited. All right, because you essentially just have to, and this is one of the problems with poor neighborhoods. I spent a lot of time writing about small businesses in New York City, for instance, in the late 1980s and the early 1990s, where we had tremendous vacancies in a lot of the outer boroughs, the main streets and outer boroughs. And so what happened is people were reduced to shopping in just one place. And they would talk about being, exploited for buying basic stuff. So one of the biggest benefits of having, more retailers and more competition is that it offers the people in these neighborhoods a choice. And the dollar stores, at least the ones I've shopped in, offer some pretty good pretty good prices on basics. It's the reason why I go out of my way sometimes to go to one of them for that reason. And the idea that a city would say you can't be there if the reason they're there is because their studies tell them that the people want to shop there. I just find that that's not essentially the role of government to say that. And I don't really, a lot of people who, frankly, serve as mayors and city council people, in a lot of cities. They're not very sophisticated about economics, too. I guess it never even occurs to them. but that maybe that these stores are coming there because people want to. Again, it's a very different situation if you're talking about, let's say, a predatory retailer who is coming in, undercutting everybody and prices, and let's say knocking out local businesses. But in many, if you look at the retail vacancy rates in lower income neighborhoods, they're fairly high, meaning there's a lot of empty space in these places. And so I would think that in most cases, just having that retailer paying rent to the landlord and offering choices to the people, no one is compelled to buy if they don't want to. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you concerning the government. That just seems to be just asinine that they're passing rules and regulations and zoning laws and all that kind of stuff. I do think that's a lot of government overreach.
Well, and this is a very big issue particularly with local government. And by local government, I mean cities and towns and municipalities. Zoning is a very powerful tool, and it can be used for good, or it can really be used to, let's say, to rig the game, if you know what I mean. And that can be true both for residential zoning, where you have restrictions on who can build what or where, or this kind of commercial zoning where, let's say, a town for some reason decides, well, we don't want any commercial over here because we don't think it's appropriate for the neighborhood, and maybe the people want to shop there. So I think you have to be very careful with how you use zoning codes. And again, this is not the kind of thing that, excites people and get about government and gets them all, interested and fascinating. It sounds kind of almost obscure, but zoning is a very powerful tool, and it is sometimes used, too powerfully by government to do things that the people in power want to do, not necessarily to provide access for, you know, local residents for what they need, you know. And I think we have to be careful. And when I read this, this struck me as one of the more extreme examples of how, you know, zoning is, writing a zoning code to specifically say a certain kind of retailer would be restricted from coming here, you know, and not really, I mean, if you want to talk about controversial zoning, you know, like zoning against, for instance, those shops that adult shops and things like that, there's zoning codes that say, you know, we don't want them in our neighborhoods. And I mean, I that's a whole different argument, but a kind of, a dollar store that sells dollar merchandise, to have a zoning code that specifically says, yeah, we don't really want those kinds of stores, and we want to limit the number of stores, I found that to be overreach by government.
Especially, as you mentioned, concerning the rationale. Now, there are different rationales, but the one that is most emphasized is this fact, what you talked about, and they're trying to help the community with their obesity and other health problems, and saying that it's undermining supermarkets. And that's just,
what? And, well, and I think I think part of the thing we have to, this is the thing that I see a lot in government. Actually, you see it a lot in life, but the government has the power, of course, to make rules and regulations. And what it is people look for very simple solutions to problems, and oftentimes those solutions are the wrong solutions. And in this case, we do have this problem in America with obesity, and it's not necessarily a problem just in lower-income communities by any means. But there's been a lot of discussion over the years about if one of the reasons for the problem and associated health problems in lower-income communities is there isn't enough fresh food available. And the thing is that there have been efforts in the last decade to actually bring more supermarkets to lower income communities. And some of those efforts have been successful. And I do cite in this particular article I wrote a study which found that, you know, there have been hundreds essentially of supermarkets that have been opened in the last 10 years. And these economists essentially studied these supermarkets. And the thing that they found is that when these supermarkets first opened up, the buying patterns and the eating patterns of people in the neighborhood didn't change immediately. In other words, people continued buying the food that they had been buying before. And in other words, their diets didn't suddenly become healthier. And the reason for that, the economist said, which isn't really all that shocking, is that this was the food people wanted to buy. And one of the things that this gets to is that, you know, the real problem with the, I mean, we have a country that, you know, has a lot of choices for people, and we have a lot of food available for people to eat. Some of our obesity problem is because of what people choose to eat. And so even, President Obama in his, the First Lady Michelle Obama's initiative, you know, recognized that education is probably one of the big issues. Getting people educated on a better diet was part of the initiative that they had, particularly focusing on kids. And part of what the economist who wrote this paper said is that it really looks like the problem remains that people make choices based on what they want to eat. And it's a harder solution to say what we need to do is continue education and outreach to try to change people's diets, if you will. And that's probably going to be more successful than banning stores.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think that is a good example of probably what should happen is a two-pronged approach, right? Because we can educate them. If we educate them and they still don't have any place to shop, then that's one thing.
Well, that would be a problem, right?
That would be a problem. Yeah, so I think it really needs to be a two-pronged approach where the economists are right. Okay, we changed the stores. Now we need to change their minds. So I think it's a two-pronged.
And that has been in the first part of that, the second part of that rather is, you know, is making sure that stores open up has been fairly successful. As I said, these economists identify hundreds of communities where through these initiatives, supermarkets had opened up. And the fact of the matter, again, is, I mean, I can remember back in the 1990s, there was this gigantic fight in New York City because a Pathmark supermarket, which was a chain supermarket at the time, wanted to open up in a place in the Bronx where there hadn't been a chain supermarket, but there were a lot of bodegas and so forth. And there was a gigantic fight about whether they should, the city should let them open up. And a lot of the people in the community, you had basically the fight was this, the people in the community said, yes, we want to shop at a supermarket like that. But then there were other powerful interests like, you know, people who operated small stores in the neighborhood and they didn't want them. Ultimately, the supermarket opened up and it became one of the highest grossing supermarket in the entire chain because people really wanted it. And I think, you know, government has to be careful. There are many different constituencies that lobby government for, you know, to allow something, to not allow something. And everybody has their own self-interest in mind. I mean, the best government has to kind of weigh what's good for the overall community, because no policy is going to be good for everybody, you know. And but when you wind up opening a store that becomes, you know, the biggest grossing store in your whole chain because people really wanted it, that should tell government something about how careful you have to be, you know, about banning stores.
Yeah, so that would almost seem to be what my other argument was concerning larger stores like Walmart, right? So you have these small bodegas. Now you got this big super chain coming in, Pathmark, and they seem to undercut, in a sense, the smaller bodegas, right? My point is that I'm all for small. I think the small mom and pop stores solidify communities. They allow easier access to the middle class, where a family owns a hardware store or a barbershop or whatever. And now you have these Pathmarks and Walmarts coming in, undercutting and buying out and close. And that's what may be causing the closing of these retail stores and these storefront shops, right? And then next thing you know, the dollar store moves in. So this may be just a cycle that people are trying to stop.
Well, and you know, every one of us in our lives and in our jobs has experienced these cycles in our own, you know, it's just like that's the balance that we face, is that, you know, life changes and our jobs change over time and we all have to adapt to a certain extent. But, you know, I mean, I'll give you an example. In the 1980s, when New York City was in decline, in the 70s and the 80s, when New York City was in decline, and a lot of national chains and bigger chains weren't interested in coming into the city, you had this whole category of store, which we call Korean green grocers. Mm. And they essentially saw an opportunity in New York because there was very, very little fresh food available, because there were a few big supermarkets. There were, again, bodegas, but bodegas in New York in particular mostly sold, again, packaged food. It's a whole different thing to sell, you know, fresh food. You need different distributors, and obviously there's a spoilage and so forth. But this other category, green grocer, which just came out of nowhere, which, you know, people didn't even anticipate, but they saw a need in the marketplace. You know, and as someone who was kind of living here during that time myself, I know that they filled a need that no one else was filling, you right. know, and so they became everywhere. Now, over time, they started to disappear. And there were a lot of reasons why they started to disappear. Some of it had to do just with immigration, which slowed down from that part of the world, into America. But by that time, the city had rejuvenated itself enough so that other kinds of retailers were willing to take over. So there was a 30-year cycle. But if you take the Korean green grocers out of that 30-year cycle, you've got a big hole in the city, you know what I mean? And that people will feel, you know, because that's food that's not available to them. Mm. And those kinds of cycles occur, you know? We haven't figured out, you know, how to stop everything in place and make it perfect. Yeah. And I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure stopping everything would ever make it perfect, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And it's a good point. You know, we have to become innovative to understand the cycles and take advantage of them to the best of our abilities, you know. So that's definitely a well said point. I want to ask you about something else. I know we wanted to talk about this situation. But I was researching you and just a lot of other articles, I came across another article that I really was fascinated by. It's called Directed to Diversify. Once again, it's in the cityjournal.org. You wrote that back in September 2019. A California law requiring a woman's quota for boards of public companies. And what the heck are they doing in California? You have to have 3 women for every six board members on a public company? And this is the government doing this?
Yeah, so this is a controversial law and a controversial case in California. And I occasionally write about California law because they do tend to be out there in front of everybody else, for better or for worse. And so if they do something and it turns out to be successful or even to be legal, because sometimes these laws are challenged like this one, you know, then it might become a national story. And in this case, in particular, essentially what the law says is that publicly held companies, now these are companies, in other words, that have stockholders, and they could be big companies, but they could also be smaller companies that go public in order to raise money. But publicly held companies, which all have boards of directors, have to have a minimum number of women on the boards. It's a sliding scale. The way boards of directors typically work in as companies get bigger and your shareholders get to vote. The whole idea of a publicly held company, as it says, as the name implies, is that it's owned by not just one person, but by the public, meaning shares are available to the public. As a result of that, shareholders get to vote on who they want to be on their board, which, you know, these are people who help govern the company. So essentially the shareholders, because they have a stake in the company, you know, get to have some say in who they want to be on the board. And also if they have enough power and who they want actually running the company as the president or the chief executive. This law said that, they could have a say up to a point, but they had to pick women, you know, depending upon how big the board was, and put them on the board. And the lawsuit essentially was by someone who said, I don't want to be forced to vote based simply on, you know, a person's gender, whether they belong on the board of my company. I want to be free to vote for the people I think are the best people, because I have an investment in this company. And, you know, what I'm mostly interested about is making sure that I don't lose money from this investment and that the company actually makes me some money. So this is the controversy that was started over this new law, which has gone into effect, although, again, there's a lawsuit right now and it's being tested in court on constitutional basis. Because what the Supreme Court has said in the past is that diversity initiatives are legal and worthwhile if they serve a public cause. That can be a fuzzy term. In the case of publicly held companies, there's no kind of articulated public cause. So what they're going to fight over in court is, you know, have they gone too far? Has the state of California gone too far, essentially? And you know, you want to talk about, you know, legal theories now. you could give you a headache, you know, exploring some of this stuff.
Yeah, I definitely can understand that. I've talked to a few lawyers, and they speak such legalese, I don't understand it all the time. So I do think that was interesting. And I'm certainly all for diversification, but, I mean, mandating it in you know, I know that causes such a backlash, and I know that I can only imagine that there's were probably a number of people who wanted to file this lawsuit challenge, whether the government overreach and all that kind of stuff. Just curious to get your thoughts on that matter.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a complicated issue, and frankly, I mean, it is a complicated issue already, and you know, the thing is, it'll be a while, I think, before the courts, and this law may make it all the way up to the Supreme Court. So it'll be a while before we see anything, you know, in particular on that. But one thing you can say about California, they're definitely out front in this stuff, and so I think the proportion of lawsuits being filed against California laws might actually be much greater than in other states.
Sure, sure. Speaking of lawsuits, I mean, we talked about these city laws, back to what were the original topics. We talked about the different municipalities passing these laws to ban these dollar stores. Are there any lawsuits currently from dollar stores or from similar industries who are trying to sue and get these types of zoning laws overturned?
Not yet. Mostly this is all just in the stage of negotiation, because we haven't actually gotten to the point where they're, if you will, you know, kicking stores out. One thing that I think could probably spark a lawsuit is there was a proposal in one city to require these dollar stores that already exist to sell fresh food. Now, that would probably generate a lawsuit because, you know, you have an already existing store, you made an investment in it. It's not easy for a store that's basically, you know, a package, you know, it's basically a general merchandise store, and the food they sell is, you know, Pringles, stuff like that, potato chips. It's not easy for them to now suddenly find that they'd have to find a whole new distributor and devote a significant amount of space to fresh food. And then the law, you know, all kinds of questions arise. How much is a significant amount? How much, you know, are you going to require me? I have an 8,000 square foot store. How much am I going to have to, you know? So that would, I think, you know, spark a legal challenge because you have an already existing retailer and the government is saying you can't continue to do just what you're doing. You have to do something else. And it's not that they're breaking an already existing law, but they're already there and the government has just tried to change the law. So I think we would see something based on that. But so far, that's just the kind of restriction that's being discussed in some of these places.
I can only imagine that would dramatically increase the prices, right? Because now you have to dedicate so much to electricity and refrigeration and, like you said, space, and somebody else has to hire more people. Yeah.
The initial investment would obviously be there and stuff. I mean, you know, again, if this is done on a voluntary basis, you know, the green grocers in New York City were just amazing in what they were able to sell and how they were able to sell it. And they were just kept it all low cost and, you know, it was just the kind of stuff that on stands when you walked by. But they really kind of specialized with that model, and they created that model on their own. And they perfected it, if you will. And it was a perfect model for the city they were in at the time that they were in it, in the urban environment they were in. But you know, to just for government to just say from the top, well, now you have to kind of like put something like that in. And remember, you know, these are already existing stores which have made an investment, and they probably have leases. So the legality of imposing something like that on someone who already is there and came there without any notion that they'd be compelled to do that is, I think, would definitely spark some kind of lawsuits. But we haven't quite got to that point yet.
Very good. Very good. Well, thank you so much. I truly appreciate you coming on the podcast and explaining it. I also, I agree with your assessment that we need to, I think the government should stay out of this type of thing, but I certainly agree that we need to educate the people on making better choices. And of course, those choices need to be available, right? We talked about that two-pronged approach, and I think that needs to happen, right? We need to have the availability and then the education.
We all have room to make better choices in life, that's for sure.
that's definitely for sure. So what do you got coming up? What do you have coming up? Do you do talks, or speeches or anything like that?
I do occasionally. They tend to be, you know, focused on things like, you know, government and government reform and policies and stuff. And so they're not necessarily the kind of things that you know, the 10,000 people will show up to, but usually government groups hire me and stuff like that.
Okay.
But the thing I've been, one project that I've been working on and writing about, which I've got some more stuff coming out, is alternate paths to careers outside of college and whether we're doing a good enough job at that. And I've been writing a series of stories on initiatives really to get people employed through a different path than just college or, you know, even with college into a kind of non-traditional occupation that not necessarily is one you would associate with college, but you can have a college degree and still work in this. And, you know, I think there's a huge amount of opportunity there, and we're not doing everybody, you know, the best job. We're not doing the best job for everybody today in America. So I'm writing about kind of alternate paths to careers is interesting, and I think something that's probably necessary at this point.
I certainly agree, and I'm going to definitely check those out. Are those also in City Journal as well?
Yeah, they will be when they come out. Yeah,
okay.
I've written two, actually. You know, one about one was a piece on trying to revive vocational education, calling it something else. I also did a profile of this guy, probably know him from TV, Mike Rowe, the guy, the Good Jobs guy, the Dirty Jobs guy. You remember that show, Dirty Jobs?
I do remember that, yeah. I never watched it.
It was very, very popular because he basically featured people who were willing to do jobs nobody else did. And this is the point he always made, got rich doing it. But anyway, I heard him speak because he's got a foundation now in order to essentially promote just this idea. There's nothing wrong with jobs that get your hands dirty and you can make a great living at that. And so he now has a foundation and he's giving scholarships out. And so I also wrote a piece about him and his foundation and what he's trying to promote.
Very nice. I can't remember the name of the article that I read, but it had something to do with automation and within the next few years certain high percentage, maybe 60% of African Americans will be put out of work because of automation. So I think that's any type of ulterior path to success, I think is good. So I'm definitely going to check out those articles when they come out.
Yes, you know, I mean, automation can be a scary thing, but then again, someone has to, if you will, service that facility, those robots, and someone has to build them and everything. So the alternate path says, you know, here are the opportunities that are opening up. Can we educate you to take advantage of those opportunities? And a lot of those opportunities still have to do with building things with your hands, you know, or servicing things with your hands. And, you know, there's all kinds of interesting stuff out there. You look at these big companies, Caterpillar, the giant American tractor maker. I mean, they now do videos, make videos in order to try to persuade people to come and work for them, fixing their giant tractors and stuff, because it's a very specialized kind of job, and they can't find enough people to do that, and they hired this guy Mike Rowe to make a video commercial saying to like the average high school kid, if you're looking for a job, think about coming and learning this from us. So that's the kind of thing that, you know, can kind of get smothered with all of the talk about, you know, I don't know, you know, only going to college or just working in high tech, or, you know, high tech also could mean, you know, fixing high tech machinery with your hands and stuff like that. So that's the kind of stuff that interests me.
Sounds good. Maybe I'll have you back on if you would like, if you don't mind to talk about that when the publish those.
Okay.
That sounds fascinating. So thank you so much, Stephen. I appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you so much.
Well, my pleasure. Take care.
Okay. I'll talk to you again. So I'd like to thank my special guest, Stephen Malanga, for coming on the Captain Hunter's podcast. Really had a great time. Really some great information that he gave out. And I'm really looking forward to those articles that he's going to publish. Probably by the time this is released, he will have published them concerning the alternate path to success. Get nothing wrong with getting your hands dirty. There's another Dr. Umar Johnson. Maybe people have heard of him. He's talked about the importance of bringing back vocational employment. So I think that kind of stuff is very, very important. The article that I was thinking about is called Artificial Intelligence is Slated to Disrupt 4.5 Million Jobs for African Americans Who Have a 10% Greater Likelihood of Automation-Based Jobs, Who Have a 10% Greater Likelihood of Automation-Based Job Loss Than Other Workers. Ooh, man, that's a mouthful, but that's from businessinsider.com. So you guys can check that out. Artificial intelligence, just Google, you know, Business Insider, artificial intelligence, disrupt 4.5 million jobs, African-Americans. I'm sure that article will pop up. You know, that's certainly a mouthful to have to type in and try to remember. But it talks about because of automation and the lack of specialty skills that many African-Americans have, you know, with a lack of college degrees, that it's set to disrupt their jobs. So as Stephen Malanga was talking about, if we learn to fix the robots, to build the robots, to maintain them, then maybe we will have certainly a chance in the job market. And, you know, with the skyrocketing cost of college education, many people are looking for these different alternative paths to educating themselves and becoming successful. So I hope you guys learned something today. This is the controversy with surrounding the dollar stores. And that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for tuning into Captain Hunter's podcast. Please make sure that you rate, subscribe, and share. The podcast can be supported through Venmo, PayPal, Cash App. Also through the Patreon page, Captain Hunter's podcast on Patreon, Venmo, Cash App, PayPal, CPTL Hunter. And until next time, make sure you follow me on Instagram, CPTL Hunter, Twitter, CPTL Hunter. You want to contact me, CPTLHunter@gmail.com. All of that is just think about Captain Lawrence Hunter, CPTLHunter@gmail.com, CPTL Hunter, Instagram, CPTL Hunter, and Twitter. And that's it. Much love and peace.